This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, Greek voters head to the polls for the third time this year, with the region's refugee crisis compounding the country's economic and political woes. A bill that would reverse a 40-year-old ban on crude oil exports advances in the U.S. Congress. And a library in New Hampshire pushes back against a government scare tactic aimed at a digital privacy initiative. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. EU member states continue to clamp down on border crossings, railway lines, and transit points used by thousands of desperate and increasingly frustrated refugees fleeing war and poverty. The refugees are of all ages, and many are from Syria, but others are from Iraq and Afghanistan. Croatia put its military on alert Friday, treating the humanitarian crisis as a threat to national security. Nearly all roads between Serbia and Croatia have been closed, and the country's interior minister said Croatia is not an open door to the European Union. Friday, buses were shuttling migrants to the Croatian border with Hungary, where the circle is closing as razor wire fences go up. Hungary sealed its border with Serbia Tuesday, blocking a major northward route traveled by the current wave of refugees. By Wednesday, riot police fired tear gas and water cannons on migrants desperate to cross into Hungary. For many refugees, Greece is the first point of European entry, both by sea and over land. In two separate incidents earlier this week, another 56 people, including children, drowned while trying to cross the Aegean Sea from Turkey to the small Dodecanese Islands, where one local mayor threatened to boycott elections this weekend if the central government didn't provide help. And at the land border between Turkey and Greece, thousands of people trying to avoid the dangerous sea crossing are demanding that Greek border officials allow them to enter the country. FSRN correspondent Eris Ikonomou says the pace of new arrivals continues unabated.
The daily flow has not stopped. We have daily arrivals, and until now, we have around 200,000 to 250,000 refugees that have entered Greece through Lesbos, Leros, and Kos. Concerning the coping of various of the islands, we do have a big problem, actually. There is a hygiene problem. You do have a lot of migrants and refugees lying on the port waiting for the boat and on the streets. You have a security issue, mainly concerning violence. Violence related to migrants being very impatient because authorities are not giving them papers. And you do have a very big exploitation issue as far as Greeks that are exploiting migrants in the islands by making them pay three times or four times the price of various commodities or main of basic commodities such as food and water.
The citizens of Greece are weathering multiple crises, the humanitarian refugee crisis and an ongoing economic and political collapse. This Sunday, voters will go to the polls for the third time in a single year. Again, Eris Ikonomou.
So, in Greece, general elections are not constructed around political proposals very often. It looks much more like a football or a soccer match, where you have two people supporting one team and one and the other. So you don't have a lot of discussion about the bailout program at all, actually. Syriza doesn't refer to it. It only refers to the fact that it actually was forced to sign it, but they don't talk about the content of it. And New Democracy, Evangelos Meimarakis, only underlines the fact that Syriza betrayed its voters and that it signed the bailout program. So no one actually refers to the content. However, or at least from the two big players, the only one that actually does refer to the content of it is the Greek Communist Party that goes to the different measures that will apply, and some ex-members of Syriza that today are much more independent.
Ikonomou says the details of the next round of austerity measures are already clear. What's at stake in the elections is who will apply them. You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. A bill that would reverse a long-standing ban on the export of American crude oil is making its way through Congress. And as lawmakers debated the issue this week, hunger strikers gathered outside of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, asking for a freeze on permits and a more renewable approach to energy policy. On Capitol Hill, Texas Representative Joe Barton's H.R. 702 seeks to overturn a 1975 ban on the export of U.S. oil to foreign markets. The ban initially took effect in response to an energy crisis and was intended to increase U.S. energy independence from producers like OPEC nations. Proponents of lifting the ban argue advances in extraction techniques have allowed the U.S. to increase production capacity, and the export ban prevents companies from taking advantage of market opportunities. Texas Representative Bill Flores.
As the world's number one producer of oil and gas, we now have the opportunity to counter hostile regimes in places like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela, and are more able to bring stability to global energy markets.
Flores spoke during a Thursday markup of the bill in the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Members opposed to lifting the ban noted that the U.S. is still unable to meet its domestic energy needs and imports about one quarter of the oil it uses.
This bill is an unconscionable giveaway to big oil at the expense of American consumers, America's national security, and our long-standing policy of energy independence.
That's Florida Representative Kathy Castor. She argues that selling U.S. oil to foreign markets will result in higher prices at the pump and ultimately benefit economic rivals in Asia.
This bill will provide a strategic advantage to China. Well, that's a fine gift as President Jinping arrives in the U.S. next week. You'll pass this bill right in time for the Chinese president, and I'm sure he will appreciate it. I'd ask my colleagues in Senate to side with American consumers, American jobs, and our own national security and reject the bill.
Others argued lifting the ban would trigger a rush to drill and produce, benefiting big oil companies at the expense of the U.S. environment, an argument brushed off by Representative Chris Collins of New York.
If we could double production in 10 years, that ought to be a noble goal. With regard to the environment and climate change, that's a matter of not of productivity, that's a matter of demand. But let's use our supply to meet the demand in the global marketplace.
Beyond the issues of energy independence, economics, and geopolitics, Representative Frank Pallone of New Jersey warned that hidden within the text of the bill is a serious threat to governmental authority to regulate oil exports.
H.R. 702 doesn't just undermine current protective authorities related to crude oil. The legislation also prohibits any federal official from taking any action at any time if it might restrict or enforce a restriction on the export of oil. The term restriction is undefined in this bill, and therefore of an unknown and dangerous scope.
The bill passed out of the committee and is now on its way to the House floor. As House lawmakers debated the crude oil export ban, 12 hunger strikers continue to sit in outside the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington, D.C. The activists with Beyond Extreme Energy began their fast last week, calling for the commission to stop issuing permits for fracked gas infrastructure projects. The protesters accuse FERC of acting as a rubber stamp by issuing energy development permits with little to no oversight or refusal of requests. Charles Chandler is one of the hunger strikers. He says that fracked gas is just one dirty energy sector they are concerned about.
We want fossil fuels turned off, and turned off soon, so that there's a chance that humans will survive. To be pushing for a new batch of fossil fuels and much more emissions at this point in time is insane. We should be pushing for clean, renewable energy sources.
The protesters are calling for the agency to prioritize alternative energy sources before fossil fuels. They plan to end their fast on September 25th. The day after Pope Francis is expected to speak to Congress about climate change and how it affects the poor. Labor activists in California say they moved two steps forward this week when the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors voted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2020, following a similar move by the LA City Council earlier this year. The county vote came just a week after state lawmakers approved a bill that will put more teeth into efforts to combat wage theft. FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports, researchers estimate that workers are robbed by wage theft of more than $1 billion a year. And that's just in Los Angeles.
For the past 10 years, Anthony Coleman has worked as an in-home caregiver, and there have been numerous times that his scheduled hours have not added up to the actual hours he has worked. That includes a current job assignment that involves assisting a client who uses a wheelchair.
You're supposed to work 2 hours. How many hours do you actually work?
I actually work like 4 hours for this patient.
Do you get paid for it?
No.
Coleman has asked his company to schedule and pay him for the number of hours actually required to fulfill his duties. But so far, no luck.
And the fight going back and forth, that is really a hassle for her and for me.
He does not have the heart to abandon someone who needs help, even if his employer will not pay him what he's due. Coleman's story is just one example of wage theft, defined as not getting paid what you are legally owed in wages or benefits. The UCLA Labor Center estimates that in Los Angeles, low-wage workers lose more than $1 billion a year because of wage theft. That makes LA the wage theft capital of the country, according to Tia Kuntz, the center's legal and policy research manager.
The most common forms of wage theft are failure to pay the minimum wage, failure to pay overtime despite having worked overtime hours, causing your employees to work through or take shortened meal and rest breaks, and then illegal deductions.
Kuhn says a coalition of unions, legal advocates, and immigrant rights organizations helped push through sweeping legislation called the Fair Days Pay Act that would make employers more accountable, in part by giving more power to state regulators. With a bipartisan boost last week, the bill moved all the way to California Governor Jerry Brown's desk, where it awaits his signature. Kuhn says it will have the most effect on the working poor. She says nationally, 68% of low-wage workers experience at least one of those violations.
Wage theft occurs at all income levels, and it occurs across industries, but certainly low-wage workers address a disproportionate threat of wage theft. That's absolutely true. And there are demographic differences as well. So women of color, for example, experience wage theft at far greater rates than their white counterparts and than their white male counterparts. Immigrant women are far and away likelier in Los Angeles and across the country to experience a minimum wage violation. So more than 50% of immigrant Latinas in LA, whether or not they are documented, makes less than the minimum wage.
Samuel Homer Williams works at a major fast food chain restaurant. He says women of color are often pressed to work harder than other employees.
Sometimes working on their breaks, you know, not getting their breaks at all sometimes. Some, you know, they just make them do like the harder labor. And I feel like they deserve more than that.
15!
Wage theft awareness is gaining traction as cities and counties around the United States, and even the whole state of New York, are passing laws calling for a $15 an hour wage minimum. On Tuesday, the Los Angeles Board of Supervisors voted 3-2 to approve the $15 an hour rate by year 2020 for the unincorporated areas of LA County. The move follows a wave of municipalities, including the city of Los Angeles, that already approved ordinances to boost the minimum wage. Kuhn says the $15 an hour minimum wage and wage theft are intertwined.
But really, if we're not enforcing the current minimum, then what does it mean? How realistic is it that the promise of a higher minimum wage will actually be realized?
Moving forward implies an education process. Almost 100% of long-term caregivers are victims of wage theft. In-home caregiving veteran Anthony Coleman estimates he's worked hundreds of hours without pay. He did not know he had any recourse until now. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
In Sao Paulo, Brazil, the prime suspects in one of the bloodiest nights in the city's history are off-duty police officers. Last month, masked gunmen killed 19 people in about 2 hours. The massacre is a suspected revenge attack for the killings of two officers in the region days before. It's a common trend in Brazil, with at least 4 similar incidents in the past year. From Sao Paulo, Sam Cowie reports.
The working-class suburb of Osasco, located on the outskirts of the city of Sao Paulo, is the scene of Brazil's latest massacre, allegedly perpetrated by police. So far, at least one policeman has been suspended from duty, while 23 are currently under investigation, 6 for directly taking part in the August 13th killings. Sao Paulo public security officials confirm that there are 4 lines of investigation, 3 involving police. The 19 killings took place in around 2 hours in 11 separate locations, composed of at least 3 teams of gunmen. The main hypothesis is that the gunmen were off-duty police, seeking revenge for an attack that killed 2 policemen in the area days before. 34-year-old Juvenal Teixeira Souza is the owner of Juvenal's bar, where 8 people were killed, including his 19-year-old brother, Thiago.
They arrived, didn't ask any questions, and just started shooting. Everyone who died here was a worker. No one here killed a policeman or a civil guard.
Analysts say that police often target civilians in gang-controlled neighborhoods after their colleagues have been slain, as a show of force to local criminals to discourage further violence against police. Brazil's police are among the world's most violent, killing an average of 6 people a day while on duty, according to a study by the Brazilian Forum on Public Safety. The number of deaths allegedly at the hand of off-duty officers, as is the case with the Osasco massacre, is harder to document. Major Sergio Olimpio Gomes, a Sao Paulo congressman who served for 29 years as a military police officer, says that Brazil's low homicide conviction rate of 8% feeds impunity on both sides.
The same sense of impunity that criminals feel, which is criminal policemen, and they feel they can make their own laws. These officers will say, law doesn't work, so I'll do my own law. Kill one of their own colleagues. I'll do the same with 10 of them, 50 of them, 100 of them. It's extremely dangerous.
Trapped in the middle of this power struggle between gangs and police are innocent civilians, residents of poor working-class neighborhoods. Osasco is at least the 4th massacre suspected to have been sparked by a policeman's killing in the past 12 months. 35 were killed in a weekend in the Amazonian city of Manaus, and similar smaller-scale killings took place in the northern city of Belém and Uberlândia in the southeast. Police massacres are a long-term problem that Brazil has never resolved, with Rio's Vigário Geral massacre in 1993 and Sao Paulo's Crimes of May in 2006 being 2 of the most famous and bloody cases. The cases that are prosecuted usually end up falling apart due to weak evidence, intimidated witnesses and police cover-ups, as well as slow and inefficient courts. Bruno Paes Manso, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Sao Paulo's Center for the Study of Violence, says that this feeds a cycle of impunity.
Investigations are badly managed, and there has been for the last 50 years a certain tendency to close ranks and tolerance for crimes committed by police.
And that may be the current direction of the investigation into the Osasco massacre. In an interview with the local press, Sao Paulo's civil police spokesperson, Marilja Pansonato Pinheiro, said that she feared evidence in the Osasco case would be compromised following lack of cooperation from the military police corps. As night falls in Osasco, the streets become deserted. Juvenal Teixeira Souza shuts down the Bar do Juvenal at 9 p.m. when he would normally stay open until 2 or 3 a.m., saying that beyond the trauma of losing his brother and 7 friends, the massacre is badly affecting his business.
Normally, the square is full at night. Families bring their kids here for ice cream. Who's going to do that now?
A white banner reading, Osasco asks for peace, hangs over a local car wash opposite the bar. But for many families of massacre victims, peace cannot come without justice. Sam Cowie, FSRN, Sao Paulo, Brazil.
Human rights activists in India are closely watching the case of an activist couple who have been providing legal assistance to victims of the 2002 communal riots in Gujarat. The advocates now face prosecution that many say is political vendetta because of their work to expose complicity of the political establishment in the violence that left thousands dead. As Bismillah Gilani reports, the crackdown extends to other advocacy nonprofits and even their foreign funders.
At a press conference in the Western City of Mumbai, dozens of human rights activists, intellectuals, and artists voiced their concerns about the prosecution of noted activist Teesta Setalwad and her husband Javed Anand. Teesta Setalwad has long been the face of a campaign seeking justice for the victims of the 2002 communal riots in the Western State of Gujarat. Nearly 2,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed in the violence, and many blame the current Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who was then the Chief Minister of Gujarat, for facilitating the riots.
Why there is this vendetta against us? Because we are seeking to show through the justice process, even today, that what happened in 2002 in 14 of the 25 districts of Gujarat was not a spontaneous outburst, but was calibrated, calculated, pre-planned conspiracy.
The couple is charged with involvement in anti-national activities and embezzling funds they received from foreign donors. Setalwad says there has been a significant increase in the state actions against her since the Narendra Modi-led government came to power last year.
It's for the first time in the history of independent India that cases related to mass communal violence, we've had judicial remedy of to the extent that 117 powerful accused have been convicted to life imprisonment.
Authorities recently raided Setalwad's home and office, cancelled her NGO's registration, and froze the group's bank accounts. The government has also declared her a threat to national security and put her main funding source, the Ford Foundation, on a watch list. Rajnikant Patel is a minister in the Gujarat government.
The Ford Foundation has given her NGO a lot of money that she has misused. It has been found the same money was used against the government and to harm the atmosphere of communal harmony in the country.
Putting the Ford Foundation on the watch list means the group can't fund any NGOs in the country unless it gets prior approval from the government. Senior Supreme Court attorney Sanjay Hegde sees this as an attempt to harass foreign donors.
What is happening is that the government is telling foreign foundations, foreign money. Every step you take, every move you make, we'll be watching you.
The curbs on Setalwad and her group are not isolated. In recent months, the government has cancelled the registration of thousands of NGOs and barred many others from receiving contributions from foreign countries. The crackdown came after the Intelligence Bureau issued a report claiming that many of these groups are using foreign money to support public protests and to hamper various ongoing development projects. Among the groups specifically mentioned are Amnesty International and Greenpeace India. Acting on the report, the government cancelled Greenpeace India's license, froze their bank accounts, and barred some of its members from travelling abroad. GVL Narasimha Rao, spokesperson of the ruling BJP, defends the government's action.
This foreign donation, a lot of them come with a specific motive, and the motive hurt India's economic interest in certain sectors.
But Greenpeace India strongly rejects that claim. Priya Pillai represents the group. She says they are being targeted because they oppose the development model that they say is anti-poor and causes irreparable damage to the environment.
There are two stakeholders here. There are tribals, marginalized communities, minorities in this country. People who work to protect their rights become, against the development of this country, against national security. And on the other hand, you have Adanis, you have Reliance, you have Tatas, and you have a government that is diluting laws, you have a government that is changing laws, bringing the land ordinance to promote corporate takeover. And that is supposed to be in national interest. So who defines national interest?
The Modi government's crackdown on NGOs has evoked severe criticism from all the opposition parties in the country. At the moment, Teesta Setalwad is free on bail and continues to work on behalf of Gujarat riot victims. But with more than half a dozen cases filed against her, a significant amount of Setalwad's time now goes to defending herself against what she calls an attempt to distract her from her work. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. Before we go, a look at how a library in a small town pushed back against a government attempt to squash a digital privacy initiative. In July, the Kilton Public Library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, set up a system that allows its excess bandwidth to be used for what's known as a Tor exit node. Tor is a platform that routes a user's internet traffic through various relay points, thereby making warrantless surveillance of online habits more difficult. People like journalists, researchers, human rights defenders, privacy activists, and everyday citizens all over the world use Tor to browse or upload things to the internet in relative anonymity. But the Tor relay node at the Kilton Library drew the attention of the Department of Homeland Security, which contacted local officials and police, warning that the service could aid criminal behavior. The library took down the relay while its board mulled next steps. Tuesday night, following a packed public meeting, the library board gave the nod to reinstate the relay point. Allison Macrina of the Library Freedom Project was at the meeting and said the support for the Tor relay was overwhelming.
It was a unanimous decision. We didn't have a single dissenting voice. It was incredible. The initial response that the library got was a huge outpouring of public support, both from their local community and from the global community. We had a petition. We had an open letter. We had almost 4,400 signatures on a petition. The library got many dozens of emails. And I think that of all those emails, they got one negative one. Then the in-person response that we saw, it was, after a while, it was kind of funny. It was like, you know, I'm just another person saying yes to Tor, and then another person would stand up. I'm going to echo what everyone else in this room says. And it sort of continued like that.
Macrina helped set up the Kilton Library's exit node as part of a pilot project to use library infrastructure as part of the larger network of Tor nodes. She says the DHS attempt to shut down its exit relay sparked resistance from other libraries nationwide.
We're looking forward to the next step, though, because when we first announced the pilot project, we got a huge amount of attention from other libraries who wanted to join. When this DHS thing happened, it had a kind of Streisand effect of folks who said, you know, either they hadn't even heard of the project before or they had heard of it but hadn't been interested in joining. And then suddenly when they saw that there was this bullying from intelligence agencies and law enforcement, that they wanted to join because they thought that that was an injustice. And we're really hoping that since this has now been a successful outcome, that it will engender even more libraries to join us.
You'll find an extended interview with Macrina, along with Nima Fatemi of the Tor Project, at our website, fsrn.org. And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to support our work and to find downloadable audio and transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Today we welcome Robert Packard as FSRN's technical support and thank Louis Reining for all his work. Music in today's show is Spinazar and Spacewalk via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.